hiding the true environmental impacts of decades of plutonium production. We really need to dig in and get the truth out about the problems at the site. We're talking about contamination of groundwater, to safety problems at the waste treatment plant. And the reality is, the only way these serious matters have become public knowledge is because courageous, committed employees have come forward to tell us and to tell the American people. Independent reviews essentially corroborate their point of view. Both the Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board and the department's own safety inspectors found that Hanford has maintained a culture that at best has thwarted the ability of employees to come forward, and at worst has threatened their careers and livelihood. And the fact that, with respect to Dr. Tamasitis and Ms. Bushy, that they were fired after this issue has gotten so much attention by the independent observers, by you, in my view, underscores the fact that nothing has really changed at Hanford. And that's what we've got to turn around.
KBOO researchers investigated the track record of the URS Corporation via the Federal Contractor Misconduct Database at the Project on Government Oversight. We found the company has had to pay the nation back more than $60 million of the $4 billion in business it has secured from governmental agencies.
A legal ruling on the Portland City Council's misuse of water and sewer funds was handed down yesterday. Multnomah County Circuit Judge Stephen Bouchong ruled that it's okay for the city to buy land for stormwater drainage and to move water pipes for a TriMet light rail project, but he said it's against the city's charter to fund a political program tied to voter-owned elections. Judge Bouchong also ruled on the Portland Luz, saying it's okay for the city to provide water for the Luz, but not to build and maintain them. The rulings were the result of a lawsuit brought by citizens and water sewer ratepayers concerned with water issues and public expenditures in Portland.
Many of Oregon's outdoor recreation spots, large and small, have been improved by grants from the Land and Water Conservation Fund. The fund is set to expire in 2015, and sportsmen across the West see it as significant that President Obama is recommending full funding for the fund in his new federal budget. For more, we go to KBOO's Robert Fisher in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
When President Obama's budget proposal came out last week, one aspect that didn't get much attention is his recommendation to fully fund the Land and Water Conservation Fund. LWCF money comes from mostly offshore oil and gas fees and is supposed to be used to preserve public land and water resources, but Congress routinely raids it for other purposes. In Oregon, where outdoor recreation is a $13 billion annual business, Brian Jennings with Black County Hunters and Anglers says LWCF is an important economic driver.
We're far from perfect, but we're doing the best job we can, and I think we're doing better than most states. We have a wolf plan that does allow the state to kill wolves on behalf of the livestock industry, but only as an option of last resort. And when you only have 64 wolves in the state, that makes a lot of sense.
Jennings says the president's call for full funding is largely symbolic, but it adds to the growing public pressure on Congress to stop diverting the money. This year is the 50th anniversary of the Land and Water Conservation Fund, and it has only received the full amount of $900 million once. In Oregon, sportsmen have plenty of priorities for LWCF funding, like gaining access to the Crooked River Canyon in Central Oregon by purchasing about 100 acres of nearby private land. Jennings says now people have to trespass to fish there.
That's really putting recovery in Oregon at risk, and what happens in Idaho matters in Oregon. And if you manage wolf populations to the absolute minimum required by law, that's really teetering perilously close to relisting wolves and putting them back on the endangered species list. And I don't even think that's what Idaho wants.
Jennings says LWCF has brought more than $300 million to Oregon over the years. Last month, a poll of 600 Oregon voters found 80% of Republicans and more than 90% of independent voters and Democrats all supporting the full funding for LWCF. For KBOO Evening News, in conjunction with Oregon News Service, I'm Robert Fisher.
A Portland woman is suing Aramark and Portland State University for alleged age discrimination in her job. For more, we go to KBOO's Don Merrill.
Until this year, Marilyn Taylor was a respected employee with Aramark. Aramark is the contractor hired by Portland State University to provide it with food service support. But on March 4, 2012, Taylor's attorney, Mitra Shari of the Mitra Law Group, filed suit against Aramark and Portland State University for alleged age discrimination and harassment, among other complaints. According to the complaint, Ms. Taylor was hired by Aramark in 2012 as an executive chef, and although she was praised for her hard work and ability to control budgets and improve existing programs, she allegedly found herself the target of harassment by an Aramark food service director by the name of Timothy Kellen. The complaint details several incidents where Mr. Kellen made disparaging comments to Ms. Taylor as they related to her age and her ability to perform certain work-related tasks. KBOO contacted Aramark and spoke with Communications Director Karen Cutler. Ms. Cutler said that because it was new and pending litigation, the company had no comment and did not have a prepared statement. KBOO also contacted Portland State University. Media Relations Manager Susan Effers sent KBOO a statement saying, "The manager and employee worked for Aramark, not PSU, so we don't know why PSU was named as a defendant in the suit." PSU and Aramark were named as co-defendants in Ms. Taylor's lawsuit. Aramark has had a history of litigation regarding allegations of age and race discrimination. Complaints have been brought against the organization by the National Labor Relations Committee on some of Aramark's labor practices. In 2003, Lola Alagi filed an age discrimination suit against Aramark. Alagi was a food service supervisor at one of Aramark's cafes in Chicago. Her suit was dismissed by the Seventh Circuit Appeals Court. In 2010, 85-year-old Mildred Block was fired from her job at an Aramark-run beer concession at Shea Stadium in New York. Ms. Block filed an age discrimination lawsuit against the company. Her case was also dismissed by the New York State Supreme Court. And last year, the Portland State University Vanguard newspaper ran a story about whether students wanted Aramark to be the corporate face of the university's cafeteria. KBOO also contacted Mitra Shari. Ms. Shari is the owner of Mitra Law Group and Ms. Taylor's attorney. She had no comment on the pending litigation. KBOO will continue to follow this story. I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
New discussions are underway to lure Trader Joe's back to Northeast Portland. Mayor Charlie Hales met with a group of 50 community members in a roundtable discussion this morning at the City Hall's Rose Room. In a statement released by the city, the mayor reiterated his support for the suspended plan to build a Trader Joe's on the corner of Northeast Martin Luther King and Alberta. In a compromise, the mayor and Commissioner Dan Saltzman announced a plan for the Interstate Corridor Urban Renewal Area. They propose spending $20 million over the next 5 years to bring affordable housing to the neighborhood. In the statement, the mayor said, quote, "This historically African-American sector of our city needs jobs, it needs opportunity, and it needs affordable housing. Working together, the community leaders and I are committed to this future." Unquote. In November, the Portland Development Commission entered into a land deal with California-based Majestic Realty Company to sell a nearly two-acre parcel for about $500,000. The land was recently valued at nearly $3 million. But Trader Joe's abandoned plans to locate a store in the neighborhood last month after stiff resistance from the Portland African American Leadership Forum. The group complained that a deal to locate the store in the community ignored the greater need for affordable housing to combat ongoing gentrification. The resulting discussion between the various activists, developers, and residents has been at times heated. The debate has centered around what is best for the community: business development, or preserving the ethnic character of the neighborhood.
Following the shutdown of the largest Bitcoin exchange by hackers, the New York financial regulator has called for regulated exchanges for Bitcoin and other digital currencies. Supporters of the Bitcoin protocol have pointed out that this may have been the whole point of the hacking attacks to begin with. The largest Bitcoin regulator, Mt. Gox, filed for bankruptcy in Japan and the U.S. earlier this month after massive hacking attacks shut the exchange down. Bitcoins have been gaining in popularity recently, but they are not governed by any financial regulator. The New York financial regulator argued that since virtual currencies are unlikely to disappear, they should be regulated by the same financial institutions that govern Wall Street financial exchanges. No perpetrators have been identified in the hack attacks against Mt. Gox and other Bitcoin exchanges, But supporters say that there are indications that government entities may have been involved.
8 Oregon immigrants and allies have traveled to the U.S.-Mexico border this week to support the more than 150 undocumented immigrants who will re-enter across the border over several days. The border action, planned by the National Immigrant Youth Alliance, is the third in 2 years. The demonstration aims to bring attention to the plight of undocumented youth and immigrants experiencing rupture and separation due to deportation and to stalled national immigration reform. Hundreds of supporters gathered Monday on both sides of the border to support more than 30 young people as they crossed, many wearing regalia from their graduation from U.S. high schools. The Dreamers are seeking humanitarian visas or asylum. Later in the week, entire families plan to cross the border as part of the continuing action. A rally and vigil in solidarity is planned in Portland for 7 p.m. this Wednesday at St. Michael and All Angels Church. The border demonstration comes as hundreds of immigrant detainees in Tacoma, Washington, continue their hunger strike in pursuit of better food, treatment, and working conditions. Activists from throughout the region turned out to rally today outside of the prison. A prison spokesperson has indicated that medical personnel may consider force-feeding the prisoners if they continue the hunger strike. Stay tuned for a full report on the hunger-striking prisoners immediately following this newscast.
A prisoner at Guantanamo Bay will be the first to have his claims of abuse considered by a United States court of law. Imad Hassan is a Yemeni man who has been held without charge since 2002 and cleared since 2009. He is the first prisoner of Guantanamo Bay to have the right to challenge the legality of the methods used by the military to force-feed detainees. Imad Hassan has been force-fed more than 5,000 times since 2007. His case seeks to highlight the amended force-feeding process referred to as the water cure and calls for a preliminary injunction that would halt the practice. KBOO News's Stephen Sherritt spoke with John B. Eisenberg, an attorney who was serving as Imad Hassan's counsel in conjunction with the advocacy group Reprieve USA.
There's recently been very little coverage about Guantanamo Bay in the media. I was wondering if you had any insight into the situation there.
There's been very little news recently because the authorities at Guantanamo Bay have shut off the flow of information. They are no longer releasing numbers on hunger strikers. They're no longer releasing any information about the status of particular hunger strikers. They've shut down information, the flow of information completely. They seem to have decided that one way of opposing the hunger strike is to pretend that it's not happening. And so that's why we're not hearing very much from the government these days about Guantanamo. All you're going to hear from is the attorneys who are representing these men.
This will be the first case in which a prisoner of Guantanamo Bay is able to challenge the methods used by the military at Guantanamo Bay. Could you talk more about the significance of this case?
What we have done today follows closely what we have filed. This lawsuit we filed today follows by about a month a very key ruling by the United States Circuit Court in Washington, D.C., in which the court held that the Federal Appeals Court and the district courts in Washington have jurisdiction to oversee conditions of confinement at Guantanamo Bay. That is a new ruling. That is a case that I litigated along with people at Reprieve during the course of the past year on behalf of another detainee named Shakir Amer and three others with him, in which we were challenging the force feeding, but we had to overcome a threshold issue first. That issue was whether or not the courts have the power to do anything to control abuse at Guantanamo Bay. The government, and keep in mind this is Obama's Department of Justice, the government was arguing that the courts have no power whatsoever to do anything about abuse at Guantanamo Bay, even if it constitutes torture, that the president alone controls what goes on there. That was an unsettled issue. No court had decided it yet, no appeals court, until last month when the D.C. Circuit held in a 2-1 decision that indeed it can issue orders controlling abuse in Guantanamo Bay. That case is not yet final. We are waiting to see whether the Obama administration asks the U.S. Supreme Court to take it or asks for a full court rehearing in the Court of Appeals. But while we wait for the Obama folks to decide what to do, we have gone ahead. We have proceeded on behalf of a different detainee, Imad Abdullah Hassan, who is not part of the previous proceeding, and we are moving forward, making some new allegations in this case. And that's the background to it all. That's why this is happening now for the first time, because it's only been a month since the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals gave the green light to these sorts of lawsuits.
Do you expect that other prisoners will follow suit?
It certainly wouldn't surprise me. There are some other awful things going on there. There are prisoners being held in solitary confinement for long periods of time. They have not been allowed visits by their families, their wives, their children, their parents, ever. They are being subjected to really intrusive searches that the Army itself calls scrotum searches whenever they visit with their lawyers or go take a phone call from their lawyers. That's already being challenged. The challenge is currently before the Circuit Court of Appeals in D.C. And there's so much going on there that is awful and abusive and a human rights violation that the ground is fertile for more actions like this.
John, I have no further questions. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I guess I would just add this. I've been litigating this particular issue, force feeding, for about a year. And the U.S. government has been so opaque in disseminating the little information that it does about how they go about doing the force feeding that it has taken us a very long time, the better part of a year, to gradually figure out what they have been doing lately, which is force feeding at excessive speeds with excessive quantities in a manner that amounts to water torture. When I finally figured that out, it was a Sunday night about 3 weeks ago. I had trouble sleeping that night. And I guess the way I feel right now, having finally gotten this thing filed, is that I hope President Obama has a little bit of trouble sleeping tonight and then does something useful tomorrow.
That was John B. Eisenberg, pro bono counsel for Guantanamo Bay prisoner Imad Hassan, and KBOO News' Stephen Sherritt. For more information on the case of Imad Abdullah Hassan versus Barack Obama, please go to the website reprieve.org.
The District of Columbia Board of Elections approved a ballot vote to legalize the limited possession of marijuana on Tuesday. In order for the ballot initiative to be voted on, it must be taken to the nation's capital as a proposal to become established on the D.C. ballot. The initiative would allow the DCMJ to try and collect the 25,000 signatures needed to qualify for a spot on the ballot. This proposal would allow any persons over 21 to have up to 2 ounces and grow up to 3 mature marijuana plants at home. If put on the ballot, voted yes by the majority of voters, and not overruled by Congress, then Washington, D.C. will be one of the new latest sections of the United States, alongside Colorado and Washington, to pass laws allowing marijuana use. A recent poll conducted in January shows that 63% of D.C. residents support the legalization of marijuana. D.C. passed the Marijuana Possession Decriminalization Amendment Act on March 2014.
Animal rights groups have challenged the stories about a cat attacking a family in Portland this weekend. On Sunday, a Portland family called the police to intervene when their 22-pound Himalayan cat became aggressive and attacked them and their baby. The story has gone viral on social The story has gone viral on social media, frequently being depicted as humorous or absurd. However, not everyone agrees on the way the story is being reported. KABU reporter Sam Smith spoke with PETA spokesperson Stephanie Bell, who believes that the incident was anything but funny.
First of all, I know a lot of people are finding this incident funny, but really it isn't. The erratic behavior being exhibited by this cat indicates a cat who clearly was upset and in distress. And our understanding is that there was an incident between the cat and a baby in the household, and one of the adults in the household kicked the cat to get the cat away from the baby, and then in the process the cat became enraged, and the family at that point apparently felt that they needed to call 911. One of the points we are compelled to make is that when our companion animals are exhibiting behaviors that are unacceptable to us, violence, kicking, spanking, smacking, screaming, etc., these things don't help, and in fact can make the situation worse. And one of the things people don't realize is violent methods of correction, like slapping or kicking, they're unfair, they're unnecessary, and the thing to understand about animals is that they don't associate those actions with their prior actions and misbehavior. So the cat had no idea that he was being kicked because he just had an unacceptable interaction with the baby, which is what made him so upset, and this is very common. And it's one of the many reasons that we don't espouse violent methods of correction with animals.
In your opinion, what do you think this says about a culture more broadly in the U.S. of the way we treat our pets or the way we expect animals to behave that are living in our homes? Do you think this is indicative of some kind of broader misunderstanding of the roles of companion animals in our homes?
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily the case, but what I will say is that people often, I work for PETA's Cruelty Investigations Department, and we receive hundreds of cases every year involving dogs and cats who have been beaten, burned, killed, and mutilated in horrible ways, often because the guardians have lost their temper in response to the animals acting in behaviors that the guardians have found to be unacceptable. Inappropriate urination, for example, ripping up a couch, ripping up an important piece of paper, running out the door when they're not supposed to. And so I think, unfortunately, we do live in a society that has violent inclinations, and animals aren't the only victims of this.
Well, Stephanie, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity and for giving this issue the exposure it deserves.
This is Sam Smith reporting for KABU Evening News.
Having fun in the newsroom.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for an interview with the lawyer for hunger-striking immigrant detainees in Tacoma, Washington, after this newscast, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes co-host Thomas from Wild Planet Radio to interview Barbara McCullough-Jones from Q Center. Out Loud will also welcome This Way Out, a syndicated radio program for the LGBTQ communities. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a wonderful high of 61 degrees and a night low of 38 degrees. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are...
It's approximately 5:30. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Medical science has long known that the optic nerve runs from the retina of our eyeballs to the visual cortex of our brains. letting us see what's going on around us. Don't look now, but another optic nerve has evolved. Rather than running to our brains, however, this one goes outward, allowing others to see us and also hear us having what we assume to be private, even intimate, conversations. Those others are the out-of-control security agencies in England and the U.S. that are secretly vacuuming up everyone's communications, even though we're not suspected of any illegalities. The Brits took the lead in this latest visual intrusion, giving it the code name of optic nerve. They are tapping into the retinas of such internet applications as Yahoo webcam chats, Google Hangouts, and Microsoft Skype. Millions of us have these services in our homes and offices, enabling us to have private video talks with someone or some group across town, or even around the world. Now we learn, though, that we're not alone. The spooks have hacked into the fiber optic networks of Yahoo and probably others to grab, view, listen to, and store millions of these personal communications. Creepy? Yes, Orwellian level creepy. As Yahoo put it, this represents a whole new level of violation of our users' privacy that is completely unacceptable. Lest you think the spies are only gathering info about terrorist plots, the British agency concedes that up to 11% of the Yahoo webcam images it has purloined contain sexually explicit content. One agent said of the mass window peeping, "A surprising number of people use webcam conversations to show intimate parts of their body to the other person." This is Jim Hightower saying, "How shocking! Not that they would do that, but that you would be sneaking peeks at them."
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we go to National Native News for the latest headlines from Native America.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Recently, an indigenous man in southern Chile was sentenced to 18 years in prison for his role in the death of an elderly couple. Celestino Cordova and others burned down the couple's house in order to assert the Mapuche people's land claim. The couple died in the fire. As Eilish O'Neill reports, indigenous rights activists are questioning the fairness of the trial.
During the last decade in Chile, the Mapuche people have sometimes resorted to blocking roads and burning down buildings in order to assert their land claims. Mapuche rights activists who clash with police or commit arson have often been tried under Chile's anti-terrorist law.
There's ethnic discrimination against an indigenous people for crimes that aren't terrorist crimes. They're crimes associated with social and territorial claims, so they can be investigated and tried under normal laws.
Manuel Andrade is the president of the Commission to Protect the Human Rights of Indigenous Peoples. He says Chile's anti-terrorist law was enacted during the government of the country's former dictator, Augusto Pinochet. Those found guilty of terrorism can face prison sentences three times as long as the standard sentences for their crimes. And all of those tried under the terrorism law lose their right to due process, Andrade says.
The use of secret witnesses under the anti-terrorist law is the most important violation of due process. It's not only that the witness is protected, but also that the defense of the accused doesn't know who's testifying.
So, Cordova did not have a fair trial even though he was not found guilty of terrorism, concludes Andrade. Chile's president, Sebastián Piñera, criticized the verdict, saying that Córdoba is guilty of terrorism. Recognizing Mapuche rights and establishing constructive dialogue between the Mapuche people and the government would help avoid further clashes between activists and landowners, says Andrade. For National Native News, I'm Eilish O'Neill in Santiago de Chile.
An Oklahoma law school establishes a Native American law chair. As KGOU's Kirk Gortney reports, a major gift from the Chickasaw Nation makes the position possible.
The University of Oklahoma College of Law will be the home of the Chickasaw Nation Native American Law Chair, the first endowed chair of its kind in the nation. Chickasaw Nation Governor Bill Anitubby said the tribe is proud to support the school in its commitment to training the next generation of lawyers who understand and care about the legal issues faced by Native Americans. Through the chair, the school hopes to attract and retain national scholars in Native American law. OU Law currently offers three different programs providing specialization in Native American issues: the Juris Doctor Certificate, the Master of Laws, and the new Master of Legal Studies. The OU College of Law says it has maintained the highest average enrollment of Native American students among law schools nationwide over the past 10 years. This year, 11.1% of the incoming first-year class is Native American. This spring, OU Law will host the 22nd annual National Native American Law Student Association Moot Court. That's where students from around the nation will compete. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney in Norman, Oklahoma.
A State House committee in Alaska is holding a hearing today on a report by the Federal Indian Law and Order Commission. The hearing will examine findings and recommendations in the report. Federal, state, and Native leaders are expected to attend. The Fort Sill Apache Tribe in Oklahoma is commemorating 100 years of freedom this month. In 1886, Chiricahua and Warm Springs Apache people were removed from the Southwest. They were shipped away as prisoners of war. According to the tribe, they were moved to Florida, Alabama, and then Oklahoma. In March 1914, the last of the imprisoned Chiricahuas were freed. They were forced to leave Fort Sill and received individual land allotments in southwest Oklahoma. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Native Voice One, the Native American radio service.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, March 11th, 2014. Israeli troops killed three Palestinians in Gaza and one in the West Bank, bringing the death toll in the past 24 hours to six killed. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Three Palestinian resistance fighters have been killed on Tuesday midday by an Israeli shell east of the Rafah district in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Ashraf Al-Kidra, spokesperson of the Ministry of Health in Gaza, said that the slain fighters have been identified as Ismail Abu Juda, 23, Shahir Abu Shanab, 24, and Abd al-Shafi Muammar, 33. Al-Kidra added that the three fighters died of serious injuries shortly after being transferred to the Gaza European Hospital. The three Palestinians are members of Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of the Islamic Jihad. The brigade said that the fighters clashed with Israeli soldiers invading an area east of Rafah and fired shells at them. It vowed retaliation to the assassination. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers shot and killed a young Palestinian man from Attil village near the city of Tulkarim in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian is the third to be killed by the army in the West Bank in less than 24 hours. Medical sources said that Fida Majadla, 23, was killed after Israeli soldiers opened fire on his car at Al-Kafriyat roadblock south of Tulkarim. The sources added that Majadla was shot in the chest and head with a live round fired by the soldiers and died instantly. Another resident, identified as Ibrahim Adnan Shukri, was shot and wounded in the attack. Soldiers then closed the roadblock and held the body of Majadla for some time, eyewitnesses reported. On Monday, the Israeli army killed two civilians. Soldiers killed a university student near Ramallah city in the central West Bank, and the other, a Jordanian judge, was killed at the border crossing with Jordan. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, March 11th, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
A recent United Nations report found that U.S. drone strikes have failed to protect civilians. The report references independent investigation of drone attacks. It follows the numerous drone strikes recently reported in Afghanistan, Yemen, and Gaza. According to the United Nations, governments have a special duty to protect civilians in armed conflict. The special rapporteur concluded that in any case in which there appear to have been civilian casualties that were not, the state responsible is under an obligation to conduct a prompt, independent, and impartial investigation. The government responsible should also provide a detailed public explanation of the results. The report compared the number of civilian casualties between 2012 and the beginning of 2013.
British and American military are preparing for unmanned drones to watch over African and Middle East nations at the end of the year when British and American troops withdraw from Afghanistan. Military intervention comes as a surprise since there has not been any discussion or information about the reasons for why Africa is a target for unmanned drone surveillance, which would start in countries such as Nigeria and in Syria for specific jihadist groups. There hasn't been any public debate about the redeploying drones used in Afghanistan, and requests to find out have been refused. General David Rodriguez, newly head of AFRICOM, has lobbied for the Senate Armed Forces Committee for drones and resources for unmanned drone surveillance.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. North America's building trades unions are urging immediate approval of the Keystone XL pipeline project. They say environmental and national security impacts have been adequately debated and addressed, and it's time to approve the pipeline and the estimated 42,100 jobs throughout the U.S. the unions say that it would create. Laborers Union President Terry O'Sullivan.
To the tens of thousands of men and women in the construction industry, this isn't just a pipeline. It's their mortgages, college tuitions, car payments, and food on a table. And for our country, this isn't just a pipeline. It's a lifeline to family security, energy security, and national security. The American people want to build the pipeline. Just last week, an ABC Washington Post poll showed 65% of Americans support it, and 85% believe Keystone will create a significant number of jobs. It's time to wring the politics out of Keystone XL pipeline and to make a decision based on the will of the people and based on the national interest of our great country.
The Sierra Club, the Natural Resources Defense Council, National Nurses United, and some Canadian unions are among those opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline. They say, according to the U.S. State Department, the pipeline would create 6,500 temporary construction jobs at most, and they say, according to TransCanada, the company building the pipeline, only hundreds of permanent jobs will be left when the pipeline is finished. A Cornell University study also says the pipeline would allegedly kill more jobs than it would create by cutting investment in the clean energy economy. National Nurses United says that pipeline would accelerate unhealthy climate change. Progress Missouri recently delivered nearly 7,000 handwritten letters opposing anti-union legislation known as Right to Work to Missouri House Speaker Tim Jones. Progress Missouri Executive Director Sean Nicholson explains why the group opposes what it calls the Right to Work for Less legislation it says will harm working families.
We are fighting back on the so-called Right to Work bills and on paycheck deception and other kinds of attacks because we know that this is about the entire middle class in Missouri and the kind of state that we want for our families and for the future. We know that states with so-called right to work laws have lower wages, have lower rates of insurance, have lower investments in education. And that's not the kind of state that we want for Missouri.
Nearly 3 years ago, Connecticut was the first state to legally guarantee paid sick days for workers. A new report on the paid sick day law from the Center on Economic and Policy Research shows it had little or no negative impact on businesses in the state. Senior economist and report co-author Dr. Eileen Applebaum says the sick days law hasn't imposed major burdens on businesses. She says rather than the job killer opponents said it would be, over three quarters of employers reported a positive experience with the law. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. You know, this is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is David Lane, Stephen Sherritt, Tanya Gomedaza, Don Merrill, Robert, and the producer and engineer is Shaquania Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 90.9 FM. Stay tuned for a live interview with KBOO reporters after this. I'm Kristen Yount.
And I'm Sam Parrish. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Per Fagerang hosts a call-in discussion about Ukraine, oil and oligarchs, geopolitics, and self-determination. At 9, we hear this week's episode of The Economic Update with host economist Richard Wolff. He discusses former Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke's speech on the Fed's bailout of the biggest financial corporations and new IMF research showing that redistribution to reduce inequality does not hurt growth. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen speaks with gardening book author Maggie Stuckey about growing vegetables in containers. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. To become a member, please go to kboo.fm and click where it says Donate Today. Stay tuned now for an interview with one of the lawyers for hunger-striking detainees at a private prison in Tacoma, Washington.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are joined on the line now by Sandy Restrepo, who is with Colectiva Legal in Washington. And I wonder if you could just give us a brief update on the situation of the hunger-striking detainees at the detention center, the Northwest Detention Center.
Hi, yes. At this time, we're not certain the amount of people that are currently striking. It could be anywhere from 1,000 to 5,000. They've been isolated, and they're currently not in communication with them, with family members or with the outside public.
And how long have they been on hunger strike?
Today is the fifth day that they've been on hunger strike.
I understand that the authorities have threatened to force feed some of the hunger striking prisoners. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. It's a policy of any prison or detention center that when there is the absence of eating by a prisoner or a detainee, if they deem it medically necessary, then they can force someone to receive food via a tube. And so a lot of the folks that have been in the hunger strike, they have been receiving threats from the GEO guards saying that if they don't stop their hunger strike, then they will call in the medical practitioners to start making assessments about who should be force-fed.
I understand that force-feeding has, in certain instances, been declared to be torture under international guidelines. Have there been legal challenges to this threat?
Yes, there has. There's currently, there was very recently a case in the Supreme Court with the issues in Guantanamo Bay on force feeding. And so it's a very, very controversial issue, even more controversial where currently, you know, it's up in the air legally whether it's even constitutional. So to even mention it as a possibility, the legality of that is in question.
And you mentioned the GEO Guards. This detention facility is run by the GEO Group, which is a private corporation. Could you talk a little bit about that and the role that this private company is playing?
GEO Group is actually the same private corporation that runs Guantanamo Bay, where the heart of that issue started, too. And so they run hundreds of privately run prisons, and they actually benefit every single day from people in detention. They make about $150 a day per bed that's filled, and yet they turn around and only pay detainees $1 a day for the work that they do. And detainees really keep the detention center running. They do everything from laundry to cooking in the kitchen and cleaning bathrooms, cleaning common areas. And it's really, when we look at, you know, who is the criminals, it's actually the GEO Group and these big corporations that lobby politicians to not have immigration reform.
Now, you said that the GEO Group runs a facility at Guantanamo Bay. I thought that prison camp was run by the U.S. military.
They also subcontract with the GEO Group.
So is the GEO Group actually overseeing the prisoners of war that have been captured from Afghanistan, or are they other detainees?
It can vary between what kind of services that they do, but that they are subcontracted within the Guantanamo Bay. So they may be the ones that have direct contact with prisoners. They could be the ones running the front desk. It varies from facility to facility how hands-on they are.
Well, going back to the Northwest Detention Center, where there are currently, you said, up to potentially 4,000 to 5,000 people on hunger strike. We've heard about 1,300. What are the conditions like there?
The conditions really are deplorable, from medical attention to nutrition to the amount of pay that they get. So the detainees have complained. I have one former client that told me he had to actually eat from a trash can to get enough food, because they would feed them such small portions to then force them to buy food from the commissary.
And who are some of the people who are being held in Northwest Detention Facility? I know some are from Portland, and many have not actually committed any crimes?
Yes, that's correct. So this detention center here in Tacoma is the regional detention center that houses all immigrants that get put in deportation proceedings. So folks come from Idaho, Oregon, Montana, and also sometimes from California and Texas when there's overflow in those detention centers. And to be detained here, all you need to have happen is to just be here without the proper documentation. So we have people that have no criminal record whatsoever, and sometimes they have to stay inside upwards of a year or two while they fight for their case, whether or not they'll be able to be reunited with their family here or be deported to Mexico.
And how many people are held in the Northwest Detention Center?
The Northwest Detention Center holds anywhere between 1,200 and 1,500 detainees. It just really depends on that week. We are familiar with certain quota systems that are implemented nationwide and regionally to make sure that the beds are constantly filled.
Is that a quota system that is by the GEO Group, or is it actually part of legislation?
That's actually part of legislation that's run through ICE and Department of Homeland Security, but the GEO Group benefits from that.
How is that legal for there to be a quota system on having people detained and then deported?
It's tricky, right? It's a suggested internal policy. There's been memos leaked from within Department of Homeland Security that say they highly suggest that the certain number of people be in process, and they also try to categorize certain people as high priority or low priority. But ultimately, the benefit in having those people detained is the GEO Group and other corporations make money from them.
And I understand that your group represents some of the people who are detained there in the Northwest Detention Center. Are they families that are getting deported? Who are some of the folks that are in there?
So the name of my organization is called Colectiva Legal del Pueblo. That means a people's law collective in English. And we first heard of the hunger strike through family members of people in detention. And they had been inspired by actions that were happening on a local level here at the detention center and nationwide to stop deportation. So they wanted to participate. The best way for them to do that was through a hunger strike.
And has there been any response from the authorities to the demands of the hunger strikers?
Not directly. We know that right now we're really petitioning for local government officials to put pressure on ICE and Department of Homeland Security to initiate negotiations, because we know the pressure that the detainees are receiving. They're cut off completely from their family. They're not allowed to go outside. And so we really want to pressure ICE to start negotiating with detainees, because there's so many psychological and physical concerns that we have for those that have been on a hunger strike for 5 days already.
And I understand that in addition to protesting the conditions at the facility, the hunger strikers are also challenging President Obama's policy on deportations. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yes, part of their demands is they know that Obama has the authority to stop deportations, as he did for a lot of Dreamers through deferred action. So the detainees are saying that that's one of their demands as well, to have a deferred action, especially so many of them, you know, are fathers and mothers that have family that depend on them that currently don't have that type of support. So one of their specific demands has been, you know, if you're a parent, you should be released and be able to fight your case while you're not detained.
You mentioned Dreamers and deferred action. For listeners who aren't familiar with the issue, could you explain what that is?
Sure. So deferred action for childhood arrivals is an executive order that was passed June 15th of 2012. And Obama said that he would do two things. One, promise not to deport those that came here as children. And secondly, give them a work permit while they regulated their status. And so the past 2 years, we've seen over 500,000 of youth that came here when they were children who have graduated high school now receive a work permit, and also the safety and the reassurance that they won't be deported. And now everyone else, parents and other family members that are here without status, are asking for the same thing.
So these are young people who were brought here as small children and are now lacking the documentation to stay in the country. Do they now have a path to citizenship, or is it just a legal status that is a temporary thing?
It is not a path to citizenship. It's actually not even a temporary status. It's not a status at all. It's just the promise to not be put into removal deportation proceedings and a work permit.
And what is the status of the so-called DREAM Act that would allow the folks who were brought here as young children to have a permanent legal status?
My understanding is that it's still stalled in Congress. There hasn't been any concrete action. And I think that goes to the root of all the movement that we've seen and the direct action that many people are taking. The DREAMers, as they're called, or the youth that are here undocumented, have really taken the forefront of those actions. And now parents and older folks are saying, we want the same, and we're willing to take direct action. And that's why there's been civil disobediences and hunger strikes to say, if Obama's not going to act, then we're going to act. I know that there's a group of 150 families that are crossing the border from Mexico into California demanding the same, demanding that there be a reform and demanding that they be reunited with their families.
And at the federal level, has there been any response from the U.S. Congress or from the executive office?
Not yet, but we are pressuring them and we're making calls to make sure that we can have a form of negotiation and that something good can come out of this.
The prisoners who are protesting through the hunger strike, asking for people to support them, and how are they asking for people to do that?
There's two ways that people can do that. One is they can sign a petition that's been put online. It has over 1,000 signatures already. It's at the website called notonemoredeportation.com. And also people can join in an action alert today. If you're not in the area and you can't come by to support, you can call Daniel Ragsdale from ICE and ask them to look into this issue and to change the conditions. So the GEO group are the ones at the ground here, and they're the ones responsible for the conditions, but ICE contracts to them, so they actually have the power to make sure that the conditions can change.
And ICE, of course, being the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, a federal agency responsible for the deportations and the maintenance of the people who are on their way to deportation proceedings or are facing deportation proceedings. Again, that website, notonemoredeportation.com. And Sandy, I wonder if there's anything that you want to add for our listeners.
Yeah, I would say they can sign up for action email alerts at the Not One More website, and we will definitely be following up on actions. If there is any negotiation, we will be sure to tell everyone so that they can keep the pressure on. If they do want to make calls, they can contact ICE Deputy Director Daniel H. Ragsdale, and his number is 202-732-5907. And they can contact him and say that they're in support of the hunger strikers and don't want any harm done in retaliation or any force feeding of the hunger strikers.
Well, thanks so much. And again, that number for Daniel Ragsdale, the Deputy Director of Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, is 202-732-5907. The website is notonemoredeportation.com. I've been speaking with Sandy Restrepo with the Colectivo Legal in Washington State about the 1,200 detainees who are on hunger strike right now. The hunger strike began on Friday, March 7th at the Northwest Detention Center, one of the largest immigration prisons in the country. And those prisoners have been protesting the inhumane conditions at the for-profit detention center owned by the GEO Corporation. Thank you, Sandy Restrepo, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KBOO News.
To act the fool tonight, forget about your worries and you will be alright.
KBOO Community Radio and Oaks Park Roller Rink proudly present Bounce, Roll, Skate, Tuesday, March 11th from 7 to 9 p.m. This is a family-friendly event for all ages. We'll be broadcasting a two-hour funk and disco mashup special live on 90.7 FM KBOO, and you can be a part of it. Feel free to dress up in your favorite 70s outfits, wigs, and costumes. That's Bounce, Roll, Skate, March 11th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Oaks Park Roller Rink. Call 503-231-8032 for more details, or go to kboo.fm/bounce-roll-skate.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
KBOO would like you to grin and bear it. It's a bear variety show. Bears on film, bears in songs, dub bears, queer bears, dancing bears, bear improv, bear comedy, bear fitness tips. I can barely stand it. And here are the bear facts. It's Friday, March 21st from 7 to 9:30 at the IPRC, 1001 Southeast Division Street. That's Friday, March 21st from 7 to 9:30. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community
Every
Events.
Every teddy bear who's been good is sure of a treat today. There's lots of marvelous things to eat and wonderful games to play.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1000. 1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net.
Peace, this is MF Grimm. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This feels like home being here. Keep hip-hop alive.
Welcome to Out Loud, the queer culture radio show on KBOO. My name is Carla, and tonight I welcome back to the studios as my guest co-hosts, Bobby and Thomas from Wild Planet Radio. Welcome back to the show, guys.
Hello, hello.
Thank you. This is Thomas. It's so great to be back.
I'm so excited to have you guys here in the studio with me. And tonight we're going to be hearing an update from Wild Planet Radio, as well as we'll be speaking with Barbara, who is the executive director of the Q Center. So we'll be getting updates about Wild Planet Radio, as well as what's going on at the Q Center these days. And in the second half of the show, we'll be featuring This Way Out, which is the international gay and lesbian news magazine. Now, Thomas, what do we have in store for the music samples on tonight's show?
We brought a couple of Wild Planet favorites. These artists are going to be also performing with us throughout our Radio to You tour and then hopefully following us right on into Pride. So today we brought three samples. I think we can probably get through all of them. The Sex Box, the track One, The Only Thing, Jeremiah Clark, Understood. Jeremiah also did an in-studio performance with us for one of our live performances on Tuesday, which was an amazing performance. And also, last but certainly not least, Logan Lynn and We Can't Stop, his track number three. Logan has had success up and down and all around, serving our community proud. So these are great tracks, and we're very happy to share this music from Wild Planet Radio.
That's very exciting. So listeners, stay tuned. We'll be featuring, again, some music thanks to our guests who are from Wild Planet Radio. And if you don't know about Wild Planet, let me just tell you their website, wildplanetradio.com. And we'll be hearing a lot more from Bobby and Thomas, as well as those music samples during the show this evening. Now, before we move on to a music break, I just want to let you know how to connect with us online. We love hearing from our listeners. Our email address is outloudradio@gmail.com. If you connect on Twitter or Facebook,